The crack is back, ladies and gentlemen. How are you, crackheads? There was a slew, to quote Ariel Helwani, a slew of fight announcements last night. A bit of a departure from the old IG, just straight into the phone. We had a whole sit-down situation going. Very formal compared to what we're used to, if I'm being honest. But a lot of fights announced, a lot of very good fights as well. Namely, Chimaev v. Strickland. May 9th, Prudential Center. I've been there. What a wonderful place New Jersey is. I mean, I think I made an impact on New Jersey, and New Jersey certainly made an impact on me. Shout out Harrison, okay? But listen, that's not all we got to talk about. Since we spoke last time, we got the whole White House card, and I know we spoke about that on the post-fight show on Saturday night, and we spoke about it on the Ariel Helwani show this week, and I've been looking around, and a lot of people seem to be echoing what we're saying here with the, you know, kind of wanted a little bit more here. There's a lot to react to with the Netflix situation. Ronda Rousey speaking out about the UFC. John Jones being left on the bench. Oh, and what about Conor McGregor? Ariel Helwani had a report earlier this week stating that things seem to be going well. I've had a few chats myself, and we will update you on that later on. But I think we need to get into these fights first. Let me introduce my fantastic co-hosts, Ben Folks and Chuck Mendenhall. Lads, I mean, what a time to be alive with all these fights. I mean, look at the excitement in the room here. My God, Chuck, I mean, pretty huge.
I think you need to visit more of New Jersey before we start saying that it's a good place to be. You know, I was just kind of stuck on that part. There's some pretty bad parts in New Jersey. I'm fine, boys. How's everybody else doing?
Look, New Jersey is lovely, okay? It's just, have you been to Blanchardstown is what I'd ask you, okay? First,
well,
if
okay.
You haven't, all right. Go to New Jersey and look.
I've got some spray paint for my trip I'm planning coming up here.
You know, as soon as he said that he thought he'd made an impact on New Jersey and New Jersey had made an impact on him, it suddenly occurred to me, yeah, a guy with Pizzi's collection of tracksuits absolutely would find himself among kindred spirits in New Jersey. It makes
true.
Perfect sense.
They actually really enjoyed my tracksuits over there, I have to say. A lot of people very impressed by what I brought to the table. Chuck, we shared beverages together in New Jersey.
Yeah,
they were
did.
Only slagging me last week, in fact, for us staying out all night. But back in my day, that was a cool thing to do. That meant you were the coolest guy there.
And we're still in your day. Don't let anybody tell you different, Pizza. We're still in your day right now.
Thank you. Thank you. Staying out all night drinking will never not be cool, okay? But we need... We need to talk about these fights, guys. Is it fair to say Chimaev v. Strickland is the doozy of the group here, Ben?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's an interesting choice and the kind of thing that tells you a little bit about where we are, what we're looking for with some of these matches, because they had options. We had options for who we could have chosen to get this next middleweight title shot. And you ask yourself, what are we looking for? Are we looking for a guy who feels like he has clearly earned number one contender status and the champ fights the top guy in the division and that's how it goes? Or are we looking for the guy who will do a little bit more to go out there and help sell it? The thing is, for me, I look at this matchup on paper and I go, I don't see how this ends up being a terribly competitive fight. Now, I've said that about Sean Strickland fights in the past and been right sometimes and been wrong sometimes. Sean Strickland's style has proven to be tricky for a lot of people to deal with. He freezes them a little bit. Sometimes people get confused, can't quite figure it out the way they thought they could. Khamzat Chimaev seems like one guy who is not even going to think about his style long enough to get confused by it. He's going to come march across the cage. He's going to put himself directly in front of you. He's going to pick you up and try to slam you on your head, and he's not going to stop trying to do that. Do you guys think Sean Strickland has in his bag the means to stop that from happening?
Chief. No. One of the problems is that Sean Strickland, he's a little bit like volatile too in terms of like what version you get of him. And it's funny, man, when you look, I think Ariel pointed this out when he was talking about it, but you look at his trajectory and it's like, you know, get into a title fight, lose, get back into a title fight, lose. You know what I mean? Like, it's like he kind of is following this pattern. And to go back to your original thing, it's a little surprising only in that sense, because when he went into that Fluffy Hernandez fight, I think that from my perspective anyway, Fluffy was the only one kind of playing for a, in my mind at the time going in, was probably the only guy fighting for a title shot there. But then you see Strickland at his very best. And so this is when he does this, and you think about that Israel Adesanya fight, right? Like, when he does this, it opens up the imagination of, oh, okay, wait a minute. Maybe this guy can compete, you know, against anybody. Maybe he's better than we understand. You talk to like his coach, Eric Nixick, and he'll tell you like he's very hard to hit. Like, and you know, you look at the numbers kind of back it up, and you go through this whole process. But the problem is what you're talking about, Ben, is none of that matters against a guy like Shamaev, right? What he wants to do has nothing to do with standing and trying to find your chin. He's going to be in on your hips in the first few seconds of this fight. And probably if he gets you to the mat, you know that a pattern has established. And I think as good as the fight looks in terms of attractiveness of the options, it lacks it in competitive balance. So the thing that you're mentioning is kind of rampant right now. A lot of the matchups of the key players, the big champion names and stuff like that, they're going against guys they should beat. And this has kind of been going the themes for this year so far. And this one, as sexy as it looks off of Strickland's win, kind of has that same vibe to me. But no, I do not like Strickland's chances in this fight.
Very hard to freeze a Shamaev double leg, you'd imagine, you know?
Yeah.
The most explosive takedown in the UFC at the moment. It's a good card. Volkov v. Cortez Acosta in the co-main. I don't really feel that co-main vibe off that, but Brady v. Buckley there, that is a quality fight. Bohovitz v. Guskov 2, King Green v. Jeremy Stevens, and Atiba Gautier v. Ozzy Diaz.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, very, very good. A bunch of fights, as I mentioned, guys. Charles R. Jourdain against Kyler Phillips, April 18th, co-main in Winnipeg. Aljamain Sterling v. Yusuf Zalal, April 25th, the main event at the Meta Apex, your favorite, Ben. Benil Dariush, Quillen Salkill on May 2nd in Perth. I'm reading these from Aaron Bronsetter, I should say. He did a great job of just lining them all up there for me. Arnold Allen.
That's a good fight.
Yeah, it's a really good fight against Costa on May 16th at the Meta Apex. May 30th in Macau, China. Song Yadong.
We've gotten a good look at it by this point.
Yo, what about this though, right? I know we're speaking about the May Apex, so this is a good time to bring this up. Bilal Muhammad, who GC informs me was champion this time last year against Bonfi at the Apex. I mean, man, life comes at you pretty fucking quickly sometimes in the UFC, doesn't it, Chuck?
It always felt like poor Bilal was kind of cut out for the Meta Apex in a weird way. Like, he never got over in the big sense as a champion. So I do feel bad for guys like that, though. Like, there should just be something in their contracts that says, you know, after you become a champion, you will not appear at the Meta Apex, right?
Yeah. Do you need to start putting the no Apex clause in your contract? The same way, you know, hockey players have a no trade clause or something?
Yeah.
It does seem like when you say life comes at you fast, it comes at some people fast in the UFC. Other people, they get to keep turning up in interim title fights over and over again, things like that. And the opportunities for redemption in big spots, in front of big audiences, are kind of endless, and just doesn't seem like the UFC was ever willing to give Bilal that opportunity. They seemed like they begrudgingly were like, fine, here's your title shot. Yeah. Oh, crap, we can't believe you won it. Now what? And then when he lost it, they were like, okay, well, we're not letting that happen again.
That is so true, man. That is so true. They never wanted to be in the Bilal business. And there are certain guys, like you think about Imovov, for instance, like him getting looked over for this this title fight coming up. And that's part of it, right? Like, you're like, well, if Imovov goes in there and wins, now we're going to have like this champion who nobody's talking about, really. I mean, they would start to talk about him, but you know what I'm saying? Like, he's just not the same marketable type of fighter. And it seems like they're trying to avoid that type of thing this year. It really does.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder how it feels to be Imovov today. 5-fight win streak, looking the part, has that big moment in Paris, and it's like, nope. We kind of had a feeling though, right? As soon as the Strickland fought the way he did, the kind of writing was on the wall.
But also, like, does it, in your minds, right? Like, we do a lot of this MMA math, and like, we try to come up with it. The fact that Strickland beat Imovov, even though it wasn't at 185, does that factor into this? I mean, to me, that was kind of like, okay, you know, it made a little more sense, and that given that they'd already fought and Strickland's the victory. But what did you guys think of that?
I think it was long enough ago that it doesn't really matter that much anymore. And especially with the pace of UFC events, how many people remember that they fought without being told? I don't think that necessarily dictates the matchmaking. The thing I was wondering about, And this is not on PC's outline, I don't think. Or if it is, maybe it's way later. I'm going
to there's a script, Ben. I need you to stick to it here.
I skimmed the script. I look it over. It comes in pretty early in the morning for me. I glance at the script. I go, all right.
I've allowed space for more freeform conversation. All right. Okay. I want to tell you that. Like, think about that now. Every time you get the list, notice the lack of bullet points compared to other weeks. That's to explore the conversational space.
I don't know. I was looking for the part where it's anecdotes from the lads, and I didn't see an entry
funny
there for
anecdotes.
That one.
That's where the pressure
was. Yeah, not just any anecdotes. They have to be hilarious, okay?
The thing I was wondering is, we make these big, like, just dump of announcements, right?
Yes.
You know, less than a week after we announced the White House event. And I was wondering about the timing of that. Is this a thing where we were kind of booking the White House event sort of right up to the deadline, which is what it sounded like when we hear these descriptions from people who are involved in different negotiations? It sounds like it was a school project we left until the last minute. And then we were looking around and going, Mom, do we have any poster board? It's due tomorrow. And so we kind of got everything together at the last minute. And was it, we were putting off announcing some of these other fights because we don't know what we'll need. If the wrong people are saying no to us for the White House thing, we can't get those deals done. We might have to reach for some of these other fighters or some of these other fights in order to plug some gaps in the White House thing. Or did we really quickly, after the underwhelming response to the White House card announcement, go, we should make people move on. We should announce a whole bunch of other fights, flood the zone with fight announcements, force all these MMA websites to write some new headlines that say stuff like, here's all these fights booked, so that we can sort of throw a little bit of a wet towel over the conversation about people not being blown away by the White House lineup.
Sounds like it wagged the dog a little bit here. We're trying to take attention off of something. And
I'm saying the Trump administration and the Dana White administration have learned things from each other back and forth, I think.
Well, it's so true. If that was the objective, to quell the distaste and disdain for the UFC White House card, has it worked, Chuck? Like, were you seeing all these announcements last night and go, well, they did it again? You know, I had my doubts, but here's the fastball.
It was novel in a sense, like, because I can't remember. Like, I know they've done this before. Well, they'll announce multiple fights coming up, and it's always kind of back in the, you know, in happier days. You know, it was always kind of like, oh wow, there's so much to digest. This time, it did feel more like a dump, even though they set it up a little different with Bisping and, you know, talking and go over, but it felt like an information dump. And what I worry about on stuff like that, and I'm not trying to just be critical because I was fine with it, but it's, you know, how do you give any one thing the shine it's supposed to get when it's just all of it at once, right? Like, so they could have maybe stretched that a little bit, but at the same time, I do think that Ben's onto something. I think that they're like, hey, man, it's time for us to show up in force, and here we are, boom, 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 boom. You can think about all these things, and to an effect, that is still how the MMA space works. You could see everybody kind of pivot, and go look at the websites today, and you'll see a lot about these announcements, right? So it worked, you know, to an extent. I mean, I don't think that it has the same, you know, pull that it used to when they would announce fights like this. There's still, like, some baseline understanding of what's going on in the broader scape, but I do think it was it certainly diverted attention enough towards them again, right?
It also made you wonder, right, because there had been such a long period without many fight announcements. We were going, hey, what are we doing this year? What's the plan? Where are the title fights? All this stuff. And it felt like for a while that we sort of put that conversation on the back burner because we were going, well, maybe they're saving a whole bunch of good ones for the White House event. And then when we saw the lineup, we kind of went, that could be just sort of any other UFC event. It'd be a good UFC event, but that could be any other numbered event. So where's the rest of the fights that we were told you were holding back? And so then you put this big dump out there afterwards, and it kind of seems like, oh, there they are. They're scattered across all these other events coming up.
I will say that, you guys tell me what you think. A lot of this feels like the, you know, torch passing type of matchmaking. Like, a lot of it has got, like, you know, a guy who's been around a long time, who's been used to fighting in the top five space of whatever division, and yet now he's facing a guy that you hadn't contemplated, because that guy's been coming up, you know what I mean? Like Arnold Allen's fight, right, with with Costa. Like, that's one of those examples of a guy who's been up there. Aljo's fight. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of these guys who are just, they've been kind of near the top, or they've held championships or whatever. Now they're fighting the guys who have been coming after them from the lower rungs and are finally there. So I find that intriguing. I like when you get that sort of, you know, you get that sort of mix, and it's just not the same guys facing off against each other.
No, well, it also seems, I mean, that's, sorry, please, that's a known way to do matchmaking. And you look at this fight card on Saturday at the Apex, and I think you see a few of those as well.
Yep.
All right, that's right at the end, okay? You can't just decide it's time to talk about that now, okay? There is space for free-form conversation, but the order is the order, Ben, okay?
Ben, you know who else used to go off script? Your boy Bobby Duvall. Like, he did it when he was Tender Mercies. I was just reading about this, how he had a lot of problems with that director because he wanted to be off script and be in the character. See, I appreciate this. I think you're one of those guys.
Thank you, Chuck. I'm an artist. Pizza's trying to pen me in, and you can't do that. I'm flowing. I'm trying to get in the flow state, Pizza, and you're interrupting that.
I was listening to someone earlier this week speak about Stanley Kubrick, and he never got great performances out of these brilliant actors that he had because he over-directed them. That's what I'm doing with you, okay? People are going to look at you in the role of Ben Fokes on The Crack, and they're going to say, you know what? Pizza just strangled him with that goddamn order. That's what fucking happened every week. But Chuck, you made a good point earlier. Imagine being one of the fighters that was announced on this card that wasn't Chimaev or Strickland, right? Like, imagine being Brady or Buckley, and you're like, this is a pretty big fight. Like, this is, right? This
and
is
yet you're like 12th down on the totem pole of discussion here.
It's just like, yeah, that's going to be on the card as well. Yeah. You know, like, it's not that we had big hopes for the UFC giving all these fighters all this love. And believe me, we have examples of that lack of love as well coming up later on. Sorry, Chuck.
I think that fighters are used to having, you know, like you mentioned, that it is a real thing. I mean, like, a lot of times one of the big shine moments, right, is when the fight gets announced for these guys and they're like, hey, I've got one coming up. I've been sitting on this, guys. You know what I mean? It's a big moment for them. That is something to factor in. You got like all these guys. I don't know how many fights they announced, but, you know, you have a lot of people that didn't get that moment of shine. That's got to hurt a little bit.
Yeah, but don't you also think that you announce so many fights all at once, we can only hold so many in our brain at one time.
True.
I've already lost half of them. Honestly.
Yeah, I know. I wrote down a bunch just in case we're going to talk about, because I'm like, I'm not going to remember all these, man.
And especially where you're announcing these events that are like weeks and weeks out. So there are a lot of them that are going to be lost in the shuffle initially anyway. And what you got to hope is that when that week rolls around, that DOC kicks it into gear and is like, all right, this week we're focusing on just this fight card, just these people. As we've seen, especially with these Apex events, that doesn't always happen. Like the one you're seeing this week, where you're kind of rolling out of, like, you know, a big event that you had into one of the Apex events, the ramping down of energy and attention is really noticeable, especially when there's other topics to discuss. And so the UFC itself doesn't even seem like it's all that interested in turning that spotlight around, at least not until day before, maybe.
Do you remember people used to wait with the anticipation for Dana White on Monday to be like, fight week on his Twitter? Like, people
fight
would make this big
vlog week.
Vlog, but it was like, it was a big deal. Like, oh yeah, we're kicking in on a Monday before the Saturday. Can you even imagine doing that anymore? Like, it's just, that seems like a different life. It doesn't even seem like it belongs in our timeline anymore.
The era of him doing those video blogs is a different life. And you got to imagine at some point, somebody in the legal department at the UFC was like, something bad is going to happen before something good happens.
Oh, man.
Speaking about potentially good things happen as far as the UFC are concerned, Ariel Helwani updated us earlier this week in terms of the Conor McGregor negotiations. We knew they were happening. He was reading the tea leaves. He said, you know, we have not heard an outburst from Conor this week. That is usually what we hear when things haven't gone well. Well, old Petey's done some snooping around today, having a few conversations, and everything seems to be going very positively. People I'm talking to seem very confident that this will get over the line, and it's only a matter of time before it does. Something would have to go catastrophically wrong for McGregor not to be announced on a UFC card, as far as I'm concerned. And that will be music to UFC's ears, because it has not been a great week, as you two guys have been pointing out in your articles on Uncrowned. Because this week, we had a bit of a press conference, we had a bit of Ronda Rousey, we had John Jones, all of that stuff. Let's kick it off with a bit of Ronda here, spitting some game at us about how it is to be a UFC fighter.
It used to be that UFC was the best place that you could come in combat sports to to make a living and be paid fairly. And now it's no longer, it's one of the worst places to go. It's why so many of their top athletes are leaving to go and find pay elsewhere. It's why their champions like Valentina are selling pictures of their titties on OnlyFans. You know, like these people are, a lot of them at the ground level, they can't support their families. They're living poverty level fighting full time. And this company just got $7.7 billion. Like, there's no reason that they can't afford to pay their athletes at least a living wage, and not even that, to at least be able to match what these athletes are making in other sports. Why would they expect to get the best athletes and these best aspiring kids that want to be something into MMA? Why not go into football? Why not go into boxing? Why not go into anything else? And so they're bleeding talent because of their short-term greed. They're thinking about the next quarter. They're thinking about the shareholders, and they're not thinking about their responsibility to be, you know, stewards of the future of the sport.
Chuck, you wrote about Ronda Rousey this week and her being at the center of this MVP promotion. How crazy is this for you to see Ronda in this situation, given how glowingly she spoke about Dana White for so many years, their relationship, and the UFC up until this point, you'd say?
I mean, she was still sort of in a roundabout way glowing about Dana White. Like, she kept saying, you know, I love him and he loves me, that sort of thing. Like, it was bizarre, but she's just pointing out that he's caught now in this new era of TKO. And like, she's basically saying that he doesn't have the power that he did. And it's hard to dispute, because what she's talking about, and I mean, of course, there aren't a lot of like established big name free agents that the UFC is trying to get, right? Like, they're not. So to come to the UFC after you've had a career elsewhere and they're not showing you the love, that doesn't happen that often, because usually they get the guys that are younger and they're bringing them in. It's within that balance. The end part of what she's talking about there is absolutely true. I don't know how much the UFC stewards, you know, its own like what its own product in this sense. If you've watched the prelims, especially in the last 2026 of these fights, you see a lot of pretty bad MMA. I'm not saying all of it. It's not across the board, but there's been some pretty bad MMA where guys just don't seem to have the same, you know, they just don't look the same as they have in the past. And so things like that, they do strike you, right? And then as far as the pay structures themselves, man, unfortunately, there just isn't too many MVPs out there. Like, I know what she's saying. Like, you know, it's probably better if you go elsewhere if you want to get, but there right now still isn't that. I'm glad there is an MVP. Like, you get happy that... right now there's a league out there that maybe is trying to change that, or at least Jake Paul has been basically on a campaign to spotlight fighter pay his whole time. He's been in the spotlight for boxing, right? Like, he's been talking about this with the UFC. So it feels like her words kind of, you know, at this point in time, when you've got Tom Aspinall, everything going on with him, you got John Jones basically being lowballed, using that word. Francis Ngannou used the word lowball when he was talking about it. It certainly raises, you can't fault what she's saying, right? Like, what she's saying is basically true at this point.
Ben, you also zoomed in on the back of what Chuck's saying here about Ronda's attitude towards the UFC. You zoomed in on the John Jones situation. And I think this is all very interesting because it pertains to Conor's situation we'll get to later. But you wrote an article about what we learned from the John Jones situation, him coming out, obviously very displeased with what Dana White suggested. You know, he was talking about his hips. Look at this guy. He can't even run anymore. He was never a real option. What did we learn from this John Jones, the latest John Jones debacle, shall we say?
Well, one thing we learned is that he's still a relevant guy in the UFC, even though he had told us he was retired roughly this time last year. So in the first few days after the announcement of the White House card, the whole question of what happened with John Jones and the negotiations there really dominated the news cycle, and he's not on that fight card. That's a little unusual that we weren't sitting around talking about Alex Pereira afterwards, and we weren't even really sitting around talking that much about Ilia Topuria and Justin Gaethje. We were talking about what happened with John Jones. And especially, I think the UFC does not help things with Dana White giving these sort of conflicting answers about it. where he's saying, John Jones was never going to be on that card, I told you guys. And then they're saying, well, are you saying that you guys didn't negotiate with John Jones? Because he's saying you did. And he said, I never said we didn't negotiate with him. What the hell kind of sense does that make? Dana White's trying to have us believe that the UFC matchmakers, at this time, when they're trying to book the White House event, they got some stuff to do, you could say. There's not a lot of free time for those guys right now. He's saying they reached out to John Jones to make offers, throw numbers around, just cause, just for the hell of it, just to see, just to have the option out there. There's no way. There's no way they were in that level of negotiation with John Jones where we're talking about actual numbers if there was no chance in hell that he was ever going to fight on that fight card the way Dana White insists. And instead of just coming out and saying, like, hey, we made him an offer. He wanted a number different than the number we wanted, so it didn't get done. It's like an ego thing where Dana White can't just be like, hey, we tried to make that deal, couldn't make that deal. He has to be like, no, I said no, and I meant it, and that's the end of the conversation. Clearly, it wasn't the end of the conversation. And then for him to pivot from that and try to add on a different explanation, well, his hips are bad. The guy can't fight. You heard him. You saw him try to play flag football. Can't,
look over
can't,
here. Look at this hand. Look at this hand.
Cover a post route. How can the guy possibly hope to compete in the UFC if he needs over the top help and can't cover as a corner out there on an island on his own? And throwing that on there, I think, is actually like a big mistake for them, because as John then points out, he's like, look, if you're saying the reason you won't put me on this card is because you don't think I can do it anymore, you think that I'm old and broken down and I can't fight anymore, then release me. You got no use for me. You're saying you won't give me a fight because you think I'm old and broken down. You can't keep a guy under contract and just deny him the opportunity to make a living. If you think he's done, let him go. Because I tell you what, yeah. You let John Jones go, he's fighting Francis Ngannou on an MVP card, or he's doing something else like that before the year's out. And I think the UFC knows that, and they don't want that. And so kind of trying to have it both ways there. I think we've seen them go through this before. You remember initially after Anderson Silva took his last loss in the UFC and Dana White was saying, that's it for Anderson. We don't want to see him fight anymore. We don't want to see any more of this. And Anderson Silva was saying, all right, then you're going to release me. And at first the UFC was saying, no, we are not going to do that. And then it just sort of built up enough where he was willing to push it. Other people were willing to push it on his behalf and saying, look, you can't just say, I'm not giving this guy any fights anymore and yet keep him under contract. And look, Anderson Silva ended up having like a pretty lucrative second act outside of the UFC. And so I think that you might have just talked yourself in that situation with John Jones and at a time where there would be other people out there willing to offer John Jones some lucrative work.
It certainly didn't help that Francis himself had put out a tweet basically saying, hey, you're $30 million, you're worth it, you come get it over here, you know, you can come get it over here. I mean, that was pretty good.
Well, and it's a interesting contrast that we've drawn before, right? Is like the path that Francis Ngannou followed versus the path that John Jones followed. Because you remember when they initially were first looking like they were going to collide, where John Jones is saying, I'm giving up the lightweight title or light heavyweight title, I'm going up to heavyweight, it's going to be John and Francis, would have been a huge fight. And the UFC couldn't get it done, blamed each side at various points, accused each guy of not being willing to fight when it was just a matter of, you know, we're not willing to pay these guys what they want in order to do that fight. John Jones eventually retreated, came back into the fold, says, all right, I'll be good. I'll fight whatever fights you do have for me. And Francis Ngannou didn't. Francis Ngannou kind of stuck to his guns there. Managed to walk out of the UFC still as heavyweight champ and as lineal MMA heavyweight champ, went off, made millions more in boxing. And I think you see, like right now, they offer pretty good comparisons. It's like one guy was willing to push it only to a point and then came back home. The other guy said, no, I'm going to push it all the way, bet big on himself, won big on himself. And now we find yourselves back in sort of the same situation where Francis is kind of saying, you still have a chance to make this choice again. What are you going to choose this time?
It's funny that Dana came out so hard against Jones that he's actually made him such a sympathetic figure to the point that Francis Ngannou, one of his arch nemesis, is saying, you should be getting way more than this.
I know.
And so is Tom Aspinall. You deserve it, buddy. You know,
Tom, whose career has been kind of hurt by John Jones, just sort of putting him off to the side, refusing to engage in that fight. Tom Aspinall has more reason than anybody to want to talk down on John Jones right now. And even he is saying, like, yeah, he deserves it.
It's just all glaring after Dana White for that whole year was on this campaign of like, John Jones, you guys are crazy, arguing with reporters. Not like when it was an Apex event, you know, and he's arguing with reporters that you're saying that he's not the best pound for pound going, you're crazy. You remember this? The whole thing.
Yeah.
He goes through this whole thing just to defend basically the matchmaking with Miocic, which nobody wanted, right? And you get that fight and then it's just been so botched. Now you're on this whole other level. I think it always, like, the biggest thing when you're mentioning John Jones' relevancy, like, because he wanted to fight on this card. And the UFC's old motto, I don't know, maybe some of the young people now following the sport that come into it don't know this, but the UFC's motto was always, we want to put on the fights that everybody wants to see. This was the counter to boxing, right, where it was so difficult to matchmake between, you know, the different sanctioning and all that stuff. Like, it was tough to get two guys in the same ring. The UFC was always like, we will do that. And they have not been able to do that. And it was just so glaring. Like, the John Jones was the dangling carrot to kind of put things back on course. And
so true.
They found a way to botch it, you know?
Yeah. It's really interesting. And I've done this in a roundabout way because I wanted to get through Ronda's comments, through John Jones's comments, and we touched on Ngannou's comments there as well. Because it feels like, as we said, Ariel had reported earlier in this week that he thought things were going well. I was speaking to people today and I heard that the McGregor negotiation is going very well and they would be very positive. They think that something is on the verge of happening. They said something catastrophic would have to happen for it not to get over the line at this stage. So with all that said, with the Ronda situation, with the Francis situation, Ben, do you think that's incentivized UFC at all to make this happen based on the reaction to Ronda obviously being on this big Netflix show, and then Jones? There's been a big outpouring of emotion regarding whether he should have been on the White House card. Do you think that's gave them a push to make the McGregor fight happen?
Absolutely. And I think it should, because right now what you want to do is book a big fight that feels like a big splash and gets everybody talking about it and excited about it, especially because one of the criticisms recently has been that the UFC does not have stars. And who do you have that's anywhere close to a star right now? I would argue Alex Pereira and Ilia Topuria are right up there. You just booked them both for the White House card and had everybody going, this is less than what we expected.
Where John Jones
at? All the buildup. Yeah. All, you know, just because it's one thing to have stars, but you also got to have interesting fights for those stars. And there's magnitudes of stars. And so to come out of that, where you just sort of took the two closest things you had, you put them on the same fight card, and it still didn't make a big pop for you. You do have a lot of incentive, especially with the MVP stuff happening, where you want to remind people, hey, we're still the 800-pound gorilla in this industry. A Conor McGregor fight feels like the most realistic option that you have that would accomplish that. And it also makes sense to me. You know, I agree with what Ariel's been saying for a while, that it makes sense. You have Conor McGregor. They don't want to spend him on a fight card where they're not going to be able to sell tickets. Yeah. Where they're not going to be able to sell out an arena with it, because you know you will. You'll get huge ticket prices and you'll still sell it out, no doubt. To me, it's going to be interesting to see who you get Conor McGregor to fight against at this point, just because you're not going to get him out there in some squash match where a young, hungry lion is coming for Conor McGregor. He's not going to like that. He's going to be able to see that. You got to give him somebody who has some kind of a name, right? But you also, if you're trying to pick winnable fights for Conor McGregor at this point, I don't know if there's a ton of options to choose from, just because he's been out of the game so long. We don't know if his body can even stand up to a full training camp at this point. I'll be really, really interested to see who we end up with.
Might be Nate, right? But listen, before that, Can you imagine? It would be like mutiny if they cannot get Conor McGregor now at this point, wouldn't it? It would just be like, if you thought that the backlash was bad for not getting, like, you know, finding out later that they didn't, that they could have had Ronda Rousey, didn't, and they, you know, they could have had John Jones, but they weren't able to get that done. But just all of a sudden, you're not able to get a deal or you're not able to get a fight going with Conor McGregor. Can you imagine what this is going to look like? I seriously doubt it happens. But it would be, if you thought that those guys went hard in the paint with like kind of their response, imagine what McGregor does. He's the one guy who's going to communicate how disgruntled he is in a way that everybody will hear louder than John Jones and Ronda Rousey put together. You know what I mean? Like, this would just be, when you say the word catastrophic, I really think that that's actually a pretty accurate word to use. I can't imagine if they can't get Conor McGregor to kind of, I guess, clean up some messes and to refocus the, you know, whatever they're trying to do here, it would be bad, man. That would be a bad scene.
Oh. If I'm Nate Diaz and they come ask me, because you read that is the matchup where you're like, you could see it. Both guys are sort of not who they were. Both would look at the other guy as being not as dangerous as previous versions of him. And you have the history there. You have both guys bring some fan base to the table. And maybe those are even somewhat different fan bases. If I'm Nate Diaz and they come to me offering that fight, I'm not doing it on a budget because I know they need me. They need what I bring in this situation.
Yep.
I think that is the plan as well. Like, get Conor over the line and then try to sign Nate. You know, like, let's get this side of it sorted and then we can go to him with it. And, you know, you mentioned Young Hungry Lion. Ariel said this earlier in the week, and the people I was talking to today said the same thing. Like, he said he would fight Bratches. Like, that was a real thing they were having. You know, I don't know if they were formal, informal chats. Like, Conor was like, yeah, I'll fight Bratches. Here's the thing. Like, I've been saying since the start of the year, there is more incentive for him to fight than ever. Like, he needs this. Like, McGregor, for his brand, for PR, everything around him gets a massive week of publicity when he fights. He has all this enterprise around him. When he fights, all of that gets brought up. That's, of course, what he's trying to do, given what's happened, like the civil case, his brand's being taken off the shelves in England and Ireland. Of course, that's what he's looking to do. So I do think he's eager to make this happen, which will help the UFC as well. But, Ben, how do you think Paramount would feel? Like, we're talking about how bad it would look for the UFC. How do you think Paramount would feel if they don't get Conor over the line? Like, he's the one telling people, I'm negotiating. Ariel's reported, like, the negotiations have happened. Like, if they don't do this again, Paramount just having signed this deal and coming off an underwhelming White House announcement, surely they're kind of, I know it's very early on, but surely they'd get pissed off at some stage about this.
You know, I think that a lot depends on what Paramount thought they were getting with the UFC deal and how much of that they feel like they already are getting or are on track to get. Because, you know, you're getting 3 million people or whatever to watch these fight cards when you're doing sort of these simulcasts. We put a portion of it on CBS, you put a portion of it on Paramount Plus. You have some stuff coming up like the White House card that you think is going to drive some subscribers. It can't be that they thought they were going to make $1 billion a year in combination from advertisers and new subscribers on Paramount Plus just from signing the UFC. That can't be. There aren't enough MMA fans in the world to give you $12 a month subscriptions that are going to equal $1 billion a year. So it must have been part of a strategy and not necessarily the entire strategy for Paramount. So I think that they probably look at it right now and go, we're pretty much getting what we want. You know, we've moved in the direction that we were hoping to go with that signing. I still think you probably overpaid and maybe they're okay with overpaying. But I think that they are looking at like, hey, there need to be a couple tentpole events coming up where the people who are holdouts, who haven't yet come over, who haven't yet hit the subscribe button, go, all right, damn it, I got to do it. But ultimately, what you have to be counting on is people subscribing and staying subscribers. They sign up for one month of Paramount Plus just to watch Conor McGregor fight. You get their $12, you know, you get their email, and then they peace up out when you don't have anything the next month. That's not going to do it for you. So the UFC just has to be a part of that strategy, and you do need some of those big events to bring people in the door, but that can't be the whole thing.
I do think that one of the things like with Paramount Plus would just be like, if they're going to be pissed, it'd be like, look what Netflix is about to do, right? It'd be like, we're going against, that's what they're looking at too. Like, they're also looking at how are we going against our normal, you know, these streaming services that are a competition or that you're trying to catch. And I think that, you know, Netflix coming in and having something that could actually pale, you know, some of the numbers the UFC is doing, that would piss them off. I think if you're looking at, you know, just kind of like, head to head, like you're going to look at something and be like, where's our event that's like this? Where is it? Is it the White House? And I know the White House will draw, like you're mentioning it always comes down to subscribers, but it's going to be those subscribers all come into like the night of the event. How many people are tuning in? Are we going to be able to put out a press release and say like, these are unprecedented numbers that we just did? And I feel like that's probably where their concern is. So you know that there had to have been a little bit of a confidence that they, if anybody was putting on MMA events and through any streaming service, it's going to be the UFC that was going to be kicking ass this year. This new wrinkle of the other thing, you know, and this other entity, I think that that's where it starts to feel like we don't want to be second, right? We didn't pay $7.7 billion to be second. So I feel like there'd be some of that going on within their meetings, you know what I mean? Like without being there. But I mean, that seems like it strikes me as something that would piss them off.
I don't want to like fully go through the White House thing. We've all done it. I know I saw, obviously we did it on the post-fight show on Saturday. I know Ben's done it on the co-main event podcast. I saw Chuck doing it with Luke on Morning Combat as well. But one thing I just keep thinking about, and it's because of the card not being this six title fight situation that President Trump suggested it would be. What happens, and this is to anyone, what happens if either Ilya or Alex pulls out of this fight?
Yeah.
Like seriously. Like,
that's bad. That would be bad.
Yeah. And I mean, that is always the thing in this sport, right? When you're, especially you are announcing this fight card 3 months ahead of time and fight card subject to change is, yeah. You know, you might as well have it tattooed on your forearm. And, or as Jake LaMotta would say, write that down and put it in your hat and it'll explain a lot of things to you. Because We've how many times have we seen it? And that used to be the strategy. I remember when we got a look at a lot of the investor documents for the UFC after the initial sale, when they were sort of pitching this other to other potential buyers to want to buy in and get a piece of the UFC. And part of the investor deck explained, hey, we did have some problems with the UFC at a point where we're losing a lot of fights due to injuries and late card changes, and it was hurting pay-per-view revenue. But we figured that out. And one of the ways we figured it out was by paying backups on retainer to stay ready. I wonder to what extent we're doing that for this, because you can't have a situation where you lose one or both of the stars that you have on this thing. And that can always happen. Once you go in that gym, you know, I imagine you're probably telling those guys, hey, if you agree to this one, we do need you to show up. So be careful in trading. Don't do anything stupid, because signing on the dotted line here means something. But at the same time, you go in there to training, you break your hand, you break your foot, something like that. You know, these guys have a lot to lose. If you go out there, you fight hurt to do a solid for the UFC and you lose, there's not going to be a ton of sympathy coming back. We've seen how that goes. Even if you come out afterwards and be like, hey, I had a serious injury, but I didn't want to disappoint, so I came out here and fought anyway. Fans are going to be like, boo-hoo. We don't want to hear it. The UFC may or may not give you a little slack down the road because of it. That loyalty is not necessarily going to be repaid from all sides. So, and they know that. So like that can always happen. Do you have backup options in place? God, I hope you do. Because you know what? The UFC knows as well as anyone how this could always happen in this sport.
Especially with an event that's basically a $60 million, if you believe their price tag, one-off, right? Like, it's a one-off. Now, they're going to put special emphasis and promotion into this because they've even given it its own distinguishing name, you know, Freedom 250 and all this stuff. There's going to be a much wider promo push for something like this, which is going to involve, you know, the players, and they're going to want to plug that as far as they can. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's going to be much more than usual. And for somebody to fall out, all of that then needs to be altered. And that's one of those things that you're like, man, what a nightmare situation. Obviously, if all of a sudden you've got Justin Gaethje against, and I don't even know if they would even, talking about John Jones and like his reliability, if they would even plug Arman Tsarukyan into this, just given his kind of volatility and, you know, they've been falling out at the 11th hour against Islam last year. Like, I don't know if they would go with him, but can you imagine suddenly it's Gaethje versus Arman, or you know what I mean? Like, you take out Pereira and you have Cyril gone. This is the problem with having the B sides kind of being like, all right, I guess. You know, when you get that element and you lose your A side, now you've got a truly, you know, you don't have a big fight, right? Like, you no longer have a big fight with whatever they'd plug in against Cyril gone at that point. So you're right, man. If something falls out of those two main fights, like you mentioned, Ben, these are the two biggest stars maybe in the league. If you get outside of Conor McGregor, if you lose one of those, that's going to be a bad, bad look for the UFC. And I have no idea how they would handle it unless they kind of like they have enough time to actually put together another fight of that magnitude.
Yeah. Well, we have concerns about matchups. Andy was showing me earlier a quote from Joe Rogan. Far greater concerns on Joe Rogan's side of things. Do we have that slide, Andy, where Joe is? Yeah, here it is. I know it's going to be very high security and high stress, and we're to have a fight at the White House in the middle of a fucking war. I would hope the war will be sorted out by June, but quite honestly, I'm not confident that's going to be the case. So that'll be weird, having this high-profile event where everyone is at one place at one time. That's Joe Rogan via MMA fighting. I mean, I made the wild prediction at the top of the year, but I don't think anything is going to stand in the way of this card the closer we get to it. I think this, like, I think Trump and Dana are so adamant that it will, like, no matter what happens, I feel like they're going to be like, we need this to happen. It is for America, essentially. Does anyone disagree?
No, I mean, I think Joe is right that it will feel weird if we're still mm-hmm. at war and this is what we're doing. We're the president's having a birthday party, essentially. And it also, I'm sure, is a huge security concern, because you know how we like to do these things where it's not just Trump at them. You know, you'll see Cash Patel there. You might see Pete Hegseth at that. Like, they like to get a lot of those people all in the same building. And if you're concerned about an attack from an enemy, you have just told everybody where the president of the United States and probably a lot of his cabinet is going to be on June 14th, are probably between these hours and these hours. Like, that ought to be the kind of thing that keeps Secret Service agents up at night. And so
that's wild.
Not only will it be like a weird vibe, I think, in a lot of ways, but probably like a really serious security situation. And if you're the UFC, you're trying to use this opportunity to really get some of the spotlight to rub off on you. You really did Trump a lot of favors during his campaign, and you were really putting your back into it to help that effort, really giving him fighter walkouts, essentially, at these events, keeping a camera trained on him. You probably look
Sold
at this
in
event.
New Jersey.
Yeah.
Pretty
yeah.
cool. Pretty cool.
You You turn right around and you're having this event and you're going, all right, we're losing money on this event, but it's still a good deal for us because there's going to be a ton of people who don't watch the sport normally, but go, well, this sounds weird and crazy. I got to tune in and see what this is. And you are probably going to get a lot of those viewers, like a lot of people just for the novelty factor of it are going to show up and watch. And you're hoping to make those people fans. And if there's something terrible that happens at this thing, or if it's just like such a weird vibe that no one can concentrate on the fights and appreciate the sport just for what it is, you're probably not going to get that out of it. So that's got to be a concern.
Well, the good thing is that UFC is trying to keep this a little bit non-political, Ben. So, you know, if we can do that, if we can separate those two elements for the White House card, I think we'll be okay.
Well, we kept Colby Covington off of it. So that honestly kind of made me sad. I don't know if Colby Covington appears anywhere on PC's outline. I don't think he does, but hearing some... See, that's hearing some of his comments afterwards where he was like, I really thought I was kind of a shoo-in for this card. I was walking around Times Square in a MAGA hat with my UFC belt. He said that basically he told Hunter Campbell, I will fight any living human being on that fight card. Just get me on
except,
there.
Except for Bo Nickel, from Bo Nickel's perspective.
He claims he wasn't offered Bo Nickel, but yeah. It's like, which that would have made sense. Like a Bo Nickel versus Colby Covington. If you booked that, I go, okay, I understand what we're doing here. I understand why we booked that fight. And if you're Colby Covington, are you sitting around feeling like, what did I do all this stuff for? It's like all of this,
I know,
seemed like guaranteed to get me an invite to this specific party. And I get left off the guest list. They're telling me, hey, maybe you
party?
Can maybe you could be one of the 85,000 people who gets a free ticket to watch it across the street. Like I'd be crushed.
Surely we've got a ticket here for you somewhere, Colby.
Yeah,
I don't see your name. How do you spell it? Like,
I mean, this is the way they're treating him. Is like, hey, sure, we'll get you over there. You walk out the back door to where the car is supposed to be waiting, and then you just hear the door close and lock behind you, and you go, "Oh, I'm just standing in an alley alone."
Well, I got the best possible consolation prize with a Dylan Danis. Yeah. What, wrestling match? Is that what they're doing? I forget. I saw that they're going against you.
Sure, anyway. Dylan Danis will definitely show up for this one. Yeah.
Oh my God. Can you imagine?
Two cool guys. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Much. We touched on Netflix, and you made the point earlier, Chuck, that Paramount Plus will probably have an eye on that. probably thought it was an open goal that they would have the most viewed MMA event of the year with UFC Warriors. Along comes Ronda, Gina, and Francis Ngannou, and Netflix. Philippe Lenz is also there, who would be brushed aside in a matter of seconds if they found a way to release John Jones from this contract just immediately. I thought
thanks for standing in, Philippe. We'll be in touch.
We'll give you $500,000, whatever. Just go away. But you again, your article on Ronda kind of focuses on this element of it. I understand, right? The newer fan. We had a lot of new fans come to this sport via the pandemic and, you know, Dana White saving sports. So they probably didn't see the Ronda days. If they didn't see the Ronda days, they definitely didn't see the Gina days. So they're kind of going, what is this? Two icons, of course. But from what you've seen, Chuck, like, is this something to take notice of, despite these people going, oh, these guys are past it? Like, it does feel significant, right, that you have Ronda, Gina, and Francis all lined up here on a Jake Paul promotion for MMA.
Yeah, and kind of aligned in like this. I said it was like 'tis the season to, you know, air your grievances with the UFC, because that's literally, it wasn't even, I would say it was, that press conference was more directed at the UFC than it was at for MVP, right? It was like everybody was just talking about the need for this kind of thing and, you know, the kind of nonsense that other fighters are dealing in and, hey, come on over here, that type of thing. It felt significant. And of course, like we've mentioned this before, we were talking about this. I really don't believe that Jake Paul's trying to form some kind of fight league, but I do believe that he's interested in putting on these tentpole type things, right? Like you put on one big event per quarter or whatever it ends up being. And maybe this is in MMA. And that in itself, when you're going against a competition where somebody paid $7.7 billion for your services to run 40-some events a year, but yet you have three or four big events that have the ability to almost drown those out. I mean, that seems significant. This is a different kind of competition than the UFC has ever had. And really, I can't remember a time where the biggest names have such an opposition to the UFC, you know, where they're being so vocal. Now, of course, Ronda and her advance, and Gina, of course, they haven't fought in a decade each. They're such a remove that you can kind of be like, oh, well, whatever they wanted to. But Francis isn't that far removed. And then you get John Jones, which was kind of a subtextual kind of like thing going on within this is John Jones's situation. And it felt significant. You know, it felt like a moment in time where you're like, hey, people aren't happy, man, the fighters and the fans. So, I mean, you guys tell me that was kind of my take from it was just that this was not, you know, not necessarily like a declaration that they're going to do a ton of events, but or anything like that, but more of a declaration like, hey, we're going to make these things count. You guys should be paying attention to what is really available to you. But like that maybe some of your big names over there, your glass ceiling is just, you know what I mean? That it's a glass ceiling on this side and over there, you're stunted, that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, one of the people, obviously you mentioned Francis Ngannou, the lineal heavyweight champion of the world. Ben, you wrote about this exchange he had with MMA Junkie, I believe it was, who kind of suggested, look, a lot of people are questioning your legacy, buddy. You know, you're very difficult to work with, all this. Did you feel that flare up? And do you feel like that's an accurate line to take when it comes to Francis?
I think it's a fair question to ask him, to ask what he thinks of it. You know, when I wrote about it and I wanted to get some perspective, especially of other fighters who are retired, because I think that we sometimes forget your legacy can look one way at whatever point in your career that we happen to be in right now, but it doesn't mean that it will look that way later when you've been retired for 5 or 10 years. And that's when legacy really, to the extent that it matters, that's when it matters, is when you're done fighting and when the wet concrete has kind of solidified. And that's when you care, to the extent you ever cared, what people say about you. And when I talked to Chael Sonnen about it, and he always has, you know, insightful stuff to say. And he said, hey, I've talked to Francis. Francis cares. I know he cares. All these guys say, I don't care. I've said it myself. But what that means is I don't care enough to choose legacy over something else like money or like freedom contractually, that kind of stuff. That's what they're actually saying. And I get that, especially because, you know, and Gray Maynard pointed this out where he was like, the promoter would love to have you prioritizing legacy, especially if they can get it in the fans' minds and they can get everybody else to agree that legacy is a currency that we alone can grant. It only exists in the UFC. It's the stuff you do in the UFC that makes your legacy. That's great news for the UFC, for any promoter, if they can get everybody thinking that way. Because that means, like, hey, we can convince you to take less money, allowing us to keep more money, because what we're giving you here is legacy. It becomes sort of like a company script where we're paying you in legacy. We're paying you in exposure, essentially. And you can't get that anywhere else. You have to stay here to get it. And that lowers, you know, your negotiating value with us. So they would love to have that. But I also think when people try to use that as a reason for a fighter to turn down money, turn down actual money for the next fight, they have to also remember nobody gets to say for sure what the legacy is right now. Legacy is changeable. And Chael brought up a good point where he was just sort of like, whenever somebody initially retires, the legacy seems to take a hit, especially because most people do not retire on a win. You know, most people are retiring on losses. And so we see you down at the very end and we go, maybe this guy wasn't that good. You can go back through anybody's record and poke holes in it. It's not until a few years later that we get a little bit of a nostalgic glow for you and we go, oh yeah, no, I really remember watching that guy fight. He was really good. The legacy sort of rebounds in those moments. But fighters put a lot of emphasis at times, sort of fans, at like what happens last. And yet when you think about it, if I go back and think about Chuck Liddell's career, there were some sad moments there toward the end, but that's not what I think about. If you ask me, like, tell me about Chuck Liddell's career, I think about it was when he was the Iceman, when he was knocking out Randy Couture, when he was a big star for the UFC, when he was knocking out Tito Ortiz. I remember the bar I was at when I watched him knock out Tito Ortiz. I don't remember exactly where I was at when I watched him get knocked out by Rich Franklin. You know, that kind of stuff, like, that's what legacy ends up being. How will we remember Francis Ngannou? I think we'll remember him starching Stipe to become heavyweight champion. And I think we'll remember that he stood up for himself against the UFC, walked away, bet big, won big, had that run in boxing, took Tyson Fury to the limit, made a whole bunch of money, like, got his whole plan to come together. I don't think we'll be thinking about his PFL bout, or, and maybe not even his bout with Felipe Lins at this MVP thing. I think, like, legacy is a lot more complicated than we think, and it's not so much a choice as like, hey, let me stay here. Because imagine if Francis Ngannou had stayed, got knocked out in his next fight with the UFC, he would have had to win like what, somewhere between 5 and 10 straight title fights to make as much money in the UFC as he has already made outside the UFC. So that part of the conversation is more complicated than I think people want to admit.
Yeah, the legacy thing in fighting especially is, but it always boils down to, what are you remembered for? Like, I mean, like, everybody wants to, like, so what are you remembered for? Everybody's, you know, everybody in their lives is going against the void. Like, I just don't want to be forgotten, you know, like, once I'm gone, I'll be forgotten. What legacy is what people tend to, you know, what do they remember about you? And you're right, with the Francis Ngannou thing, as it's still unfolding, and obviously, like, he's still doing something. He had a crazy backstory, and I mean, that still plays into it, right? Like, just, here's this guy who made a life for himself and kind of succeeded at every level and went against the UFC. In a weird way, that's legacy enough. It's outside of the bounds of just being a UFC fighter, right? But it's like, it's a larger legacy in that sense, even if you don't want to place it within the greatness of within his UFC career, right? Like, It's interesting. I think it was Graham Maynard who basically pointed out, maybe that's in your piece, like, he was like, maybe that's how he'll be remembered, you know?
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing. I'm with you, though. You mentioned, like, Chael Sonnen, for instance. When I think of him, I think of the first time I felt like real blood, lifeblood was pumped into the UFC before UFC 117, because there had never been somebody poking a champion the way he was Anderson Silva. To me, that was like one of the craziest and most fun moments in all of UFC history. It was watching him, this wrestler who's coming for him. You believed him at some point, like, he's going to go in there. He's not going to fight Anderson Silva. He's going to beat Anderson Silva. You know, he's like, he's telling you these things and you're like, okay, this is crazy. Nobody's talked about Anderson Silva. He's been nothing but revered, you know? So, like, he kind of put the playbook out there on how to handle yourself when you're building a fight, how to create hype, how to dress mediocrity up, and, like, I'm not trying to badmouth him but he wasn't the greatest record in the UFC, but, like, how to dress mediocrity up for, like, to look really great, you know? He did that stuff. He showed the blueprint. So, like, you look at him as a key figure in the UFC, and to me, like, that's kind of the legacy, you know? Yeah. Like, what you did.
Well, and I think you're right also to point out that Francis Ngannou is a man who crossed the Mediterranean basically in a raft twice.
Yeah.
Because he got sent back the first time into a refugee camp to go be homeless on the streets of Paris just to chase this dream. And if you turn around years later and say to that guy, aren't you worried that fight fans might say some things about you that you don't like? He's going to say, no, that is not among the great worries in my life. I am not concerned about that, especially because what he's saying, you know, you've heard other fighters say it. You can't eat legacy. You can't eat the belt. You know, the money that he's gotten and that he is going to continue to get outside the UFC, the freedom that he's going to get to choose what he wants to do, the ability that he has to like turn around and use that money to do things for his family or his community or whatever. That I'm sure ranks way higher for him than where fight fans rank you when they're having these Batman versus Superman type conversations 10 years from now.
And I will say that he doesn't even look at the prices on menus anymore. He can afford anything on that menu.
He's getting apps every time. You know? They're saying, hey, do you realize the Caesar salad comes with an upcharge? It's not the house salad. He's saying, why are you wasting my time telling me
that? Just bring me the Caesar salad, please.
As you guys are talking, I'm just thinking like legacies in terms of like, think about someone like Jake LaMotta and all of the things that were in the press about him before Raging Bull comes out. And then you synthesize his life into these astronomical moments, these fights. We're not talking about throwing fights to potentially get title fights down the line, all this kind of stuff. And even though he's portrayed as quite a negative person in Robert De Niro's portrayal of him, it's still like the takeaway is like, what a fucking legend this guy is. You know, you move away. At the end of it, you're like, what an incredible accomplishment. If they fucking did a motion picture of Francis Ngannou's life, which is very likely. Like, just based on what Ben's just said. Like, it's fucking insane, the shit that this guy had to do. He winds up in Paris, and he's just like, oh, yeah, I fancy boxing. And then 5 years later, he's basically the UFC heavyweight champion. It's fucking insane what happened with this guy's life.
Well, I'd like to see one more Mark Kerr movie before we see that. But yes, I would like to see that eventually.
I think there's still unexamined territory left there. I think it is, especially because when he was asked this by the MMA Junkie reporter and he was saying, what is legacy? Define that for me. And like, who's an example? And the guy said, Muhammad Ali. And he was like, yeah. The thing is, now everybody wants to tell you how much they love Muhammad Ali. Yeah. And that part of his legacy, a big part of his legacy, was not just that he was a great fighter, arguably the greatest heavyweight boxer of all time. A big part of his legacy was the social stances that he took, the price he was willing to pay personally and professionally for standing on those principles. And that was a deeply unpopular stance at the time. It's easy to see now that he was on the right side of it and that, you know, he took the right stance and to applaud him for being willing to do that. And yet that's retrospect. People who were alive at the time would tell you, and if you go look and you look at what people were writing and saying about him at the time, they hated him for it. Absolutely hated him for it. And so that's another reminder that legacy isn't necessarily the view from right now. Legacy includes a lot of other stuff, and it's going to be a conversation that happens down the road.
Do you have like the New York Times like time machine type thing? It's so fun to go back and see kind of, because you can pick up tone, if nothing else, what people say, the quotes and stuff, but the tone too of like, go look at all of Muhammad Ali's stuff, man. There's such a negative tone to it all. Including in the stuff where he was doing good work, like, you know, the Watts parade thing that they were doing in 1967. Like, there's such a negative tone about him because nobody liked him at this moment in time. It was so bizarre, man. But yes, retrospect, now he's the legend, right? Like, he left this legacy, but it was certainly not that way at the time.
Yo, Tyson, even an example. Like, I was thinking after reading that Kriegel book about Tyson, he's talking about him being like the designated villain of the world, basically. Like, this is the guy. It's just like, this is the guy that you hate. Like, he is there. He has given us plenty of reason to do it. Go for it. Completely changed through Netflix, which brings me to another question about Netflix. Jake Paul and Ngannou are going at it. This might be a purist point of view from me, but I think that's a bad idea. I think if you have Ngannou and you can make MMA fights, and obviously Felipe Lenz is not lending himself to that conversation as you can make captivating MMA fights, but do you think it's a bad move, Chuck, to make a Ngannou v Paul fight if you're trying to take on the UFC and be the established name in MMA? Or am I just,
I just don't have any interest in it, man. You know, I the Jake Paul thing. Okay, he's doing. I can appreciate what he's doing right now, like putting on fights. But you know, you just watch the Anthony Joshua thing, and what else are we waiting to see? Like, he gets his jaw broken. I'm like, at some point, you're like, what are we just watching Jake Paul get beat up by big guys now? I mean, I just don't really have a big interest in it.
Hang on, you're selling me on this. You've sold it. Wait a second. I take back my previous comment. Then what you do?
Well, also, isn't one of the things that we learned from that Jake Paul-Anthony Joshua fight that these weight classes exist for a reason?
Yeah.
And so if you were going to say, like, all right, I couldn't beat that bigger, stronger boxer. But what about this bigger, stronger boxer?
I know, yeah.
And especially like the case for the fight would essentially be what? I didn't get beat as quickly as that guy got beat by Anthony Joshua.
Right.
I mean, I think a lot of people would also turn around and be like, Francis was fighting like he was trying to beat Anthony Joshua.
that's nitpicking, isn't it?
That's part of why he got knocked out as quickly as he did, is because he went out there fighting like, I think I'm going to knock this guy out. Jake Paul went out there fighting like, I would like to survive. That was clearly all he wanted to do in that fight. And so, you know, there are those comparisons, but it is, I mean, Jake Paul's a great salesman for Jake Paul. So I don't doubt that he could get people worked up for a Francis Ngannou fight at some point. I guess I would wonder, is that really what you want to do, Jake? Because there's other work out there for you that would probably.
He's doing fine with this. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, also I'll say, I remember doing a story about this, about broken jaws and why it's such a difficult injury, especially psychologically, the recovery where you have your jaw wired shut for 6 weeks. One of the things I learned doing that was that once you get your jaw broken once, it's a lot easier for it to happen a second time. I talked to four or five guys who had gone through the broken jaw, and all but one of them had later suffered another broken jaw in training or fighting. So, you know, heads up on that.
Francis.
One.
Is the kind of exception to the rule, though, of don't bite the hand that feeds you or whatever. Like, here he is wanting to, like, beat up the guy who's paying him a ton of money to come over. Yeah. And I mean, that's weird, too, you know? It's just, it's like, such a weird, it's a weird dynamic.
Every time you speak, you're selling me on this fight. Every time you open your mouth.
What I'm saying is they need to book this for third quarter, fourth quarter, somewhere in that range. We'll be there.
Sold. Sold. Look. Huge things happen in the UFC. We had to talk about all this stuff, you know, this, you know, negative, some people would say, Ronda Rousey, John Jones, what that means to the McGregor negotiations. But there's a positive story to end this all, because there's one man who is very, very excited to be fighting in the UFC. And Chuck, you managed to speak to him. Vashejos, I believe, is how we say the name. Andy, am I correct there? Is it Vashejos? Can you speak to that, Andy?
I don't know. Vashejos.
I'm like a fucking...
I call him Kevin. I mean, we're just like, yeah.
Kevin's like a lot easier.
Yeah, I talked to him. I talked to him and, that's what struck me, honestly. It's like the rest of the world's burning down around him in the MMA space. But here he was like, you know, just glowing with this opportunity and, you know, basically having a pinch me moment that he gets his own main event. And I mean, it's always fun to talk to a young dude. I think he's 24 years old, who's in that spot and fighting a veteran guy where you're basically supposed to kind of take that dude's juice. And now you move into the top spaces and like, you see what you can do. He was very much into that, you know, and I think that he's of all of the cynical stuff and all of the, you know, bad things going on, like, you talk to somebody like that, it helps refresh your, like, you know, give you a little bit of a refreshing course in like what it's supposed to be like. And he certainly has that attitude right now.
Yeah. You know, the part that jumped out to me was this quote where he says, to be 24 years old after only my third fight, I'm already in a main event and have my name and my face on a poster. I'm excited. I'm happy, not just for myself, but for my family, because they've been behind me all the way. So very excited, very happy with the opportunity that was given. It reminded me of, you ever see that movie, the Adam Sandler movie, Funny People, where he plays basically an Adam Sandler type character, and you know, Seth Rogen plays the up and coming comedian who he's hired to help him write
this
jokes.
Sounds like a great movie.
It has a great first two thirds. They didn't exactly land the plane in this one, but it might still be. It's worth seeing, and it's also worth seeing that Adam Sandler has a sense of humor about the kind of career he's had and some of the choices he's made in it, but. There's a part where he's flying the guy with him on a private plane, like from LA to San Francisco to go do a gig. And, you know, he's looking at how excited this young poor comedian is about all this stuff, riding in a limo, flying in a private plane. Oh my God, this is very exciting. And he says something along the way where he's like, "You're excited, huh?" And he's like, "Yeah." And he's like, "I remember I used to be excited." And it's that kind of a thing where, like, it is good to see somebody like come in where it's just like, yeah, he's 24. All this stuff is so new. He's not looking at it and being like, "Oh, great, I'm on an Apex card." He's looking at it being like, "I'm in the main event of an Apex card. Right. They put my face on a poster. That's exciting. That's also new." And that is one of the things that I think that you can get. The same way, like, you look at how your kids get really excited for Christmas and you go, "Oh, yeah, okay, I'm kind of seeing it through their eyes. I get some of that excitement to rub off on me." I'm just glad that you wrote this story about him, Chuck, just so we can kind of get that secondhand excitement off of him.
That's exactly what it was. That was exactly what it felt like. You're looking through his eyes for a minute, like, "You know, it isn't so bad. This is going to be fun, you know?
Hey, your name on a poster. That's cool, man."
I can't wait. I'll be watching. You know, I did say I swore off the Apex cards, but I will be just coming back from a big boxing event.
Real quick, but Ben, which other fights on that Apex card are you circling, man? Which one should we keep our eyes on?
You know what? If I was Victor Petrino and I had been in the heavyweight rankings.
He actually had one. He's looked at it. All right, this joke failed. Go ahead.
I had been in the heavyweight rankings. I had a fight booked, but nothing had happened at heavyweight for weeks. And then I look one day, and the week leading up to my fight, I was out of the rankings and Tai Tuivasa was back in. I'd be like, "What the hell? What are you guys doing over there? Let me go in there and take somebody's head off and remind you that I should be in the rankings and not Tai Tuivasa, who hasn't won a fight since, you know, the Biden administration almost."
It's probably about right, actually.
That's one I'd be circling, but then I know better than to be circling heavyweight fights on the Apex.
It's a fair point.
You get what you deserve if you start looking forward to those.
It's an educated take, to be fair.
I'm sorry, PC. You're talking about your event. Where are you going?
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. I'm going to, there's a big boxing event on in Three Arena this weekend. Jazza Dickens v. Anto Kakachi for the World Super Featherweight title, I believe. It's interesting for a number of reasons because, you know, pro boxing in Ireland, like in Dublin, in the Republic, pretty much stopped around 2016 when there was a shooting at the Regency Hotel, a weigh-in. David Byrne died. It was actually an attempted assassination of Daniel Kinahan. And basically after that, the Hutch and Kinahan feud broke out. 18 people were killed in this feud. And insurance companies, the police themselves, were just like, "We don't want boxing here at all." So Katie Taylor comes back. Yeah, crazy. Katie Taylor comes back in 2023 with Chantel Cameron. And that was the first time. And it took someone like Katie Taylor, like a national icon, to make boxing happen again. But since that first Cameron fight, this will be the fifth fight from then. And really, like, if you were looking at this card as a boxing fan, a lot of names aren't going to be jumping out at you. But that speaks to the appetite that's here now all of a sudden. You know, suddenly people are casually going to boxing events. This is a sold out event. I'm very interested to just see, there's great fights as well. Pierce O'Leary, people are telling me this guy, he lives about 200 meters from the Three Arena, a real inner city dub. People are telling me he basically sold this thing out himself. Obviously, a title fight as well against Maxi Hughes, a big knockout artist, a lot of people very excited. But for me, it's like, this kind of speaks to Irish boxing being revived, at least in the South. Belfast's always been a big boxing city, but in Dublin itself, in the south of Ireland, this is a huge deal. And basically, I'm going there to get a kind of finger on the pulse of what boxing people are saying, are feeling about this, because it could all help towards this natural climax that could happen at Croe Park that Eddie Hearn is telling us.
Okay, see, I was going to say. When you were telling me there's boxing happening at Three Arena, I was going, "Oh yeah, not at Croke Park, the mythical Croke Park." What a surprise.
It doesn't exist, by the way, Ben.
What a surprise that we're not doing, yet again, we are not doing a fighting event at Croke Park.
For those of you who don't know, Ben doesn't think Croke Park exists.
Goddamn Narnia, it might as well be. I've been hearing about it for so many years. All this, we're always just about to book a big fight at Croke Park. No, it never happens.
Since the days of Mike Straka.
2026, boys. It's the year. It's coming home. Boxing is coming home. Cover it all, boys. Once again, we fucking nailed it. We smashed the shit out of this show. Crackheads, I mean, what a pleasure. I was just about to
There
go.
It is. He was getting his sign off kind of.
I was.
Feel
I was
going.
I think he was going to. You were going to remember, I think.
I wasn't. Though. Fine,
okay.
Thank you.
All right. Well, then good. Good. You had that coming then.
What have we got? Has the lack of a raven cost Imhoff?
There it
is.
Is
a good fan, folks.
There it is. Yeah. There it is. Exactly. Imagine how much more attractive a number one contender prospect he would be if we all knew Nassourdine Imhoff as the guy who goes around with a mysterious raven on his shoulder and refuses to explain it.
Wait, now, wait. This wasn't just pulled up. Did you talk about this somewhere? What am I missing?
I've mentioned
here?
This before on the
okay,
CME. I don't know if
okay,
I've ever mentioned
all right,
it.
All right,
on the
my God.
I was like, that's really, then I was like, no way, we're just aligning visions
here. This was
here
a suggestion.
Suddenly.
This is a okay, suggestion right. we made to Nassourdine Imhoff because we realized the situation he was in. He's winning all these fights, right? He's clearly very good. He seems to disappear completely from our imaginations in between fights. Like, nobody really talks about him until he has a fight booked or until there's a situation like this where you're going, why didn't he get this fight booked? Imagine how much you could change that if you just, you had a pet raven. It rode around on your shoulder. You refuse to explain anything about it, but you're also never without the raven. Every once in a while, you'll be at press conferences or something. People ask you a question. You turn your ear. The raven appears to be whispering something in your ear. You nod, and then you answer the question. We never find out what is happening between you and this raven. When it's fight time, you walk down to the cage with the raven perched on your shoulder. You get to the Harley Davidson prep point or whatever we're calling it now. You're shaking hands, you're checking your mouthpiece, getting the Vaseline on. Just before you step into the cage, you and the raven make eye contact. The raven flies up off your shoulder into the darkness of the rafters of the arena where it presumably stays. Everybody in the crowd is going, is that raven up there somewhere right now? Like, do we need to worry about that raven? Maybe in between rounds, you come back, you sit down on the stool. The raven flies back down, perches on the top of the cage. You're just kind of looking at it, and you seem to be communicating with the raven, flies back up into the darkness. If you were that guy, if you were the raven guy, Nassourdine Imhoff, we'd remember who you are. You know what I'm saying?
Okay, dude,
we would all know the raven guy.
This is brilliant. This is brilliant. I took notes. I'm going to fucking suggest this stuff to
Tell
him,
me
man.
You
I,
wouldn't want to see Nassourdine the raven Imhoff. Against Khamzat Chimaev.
I love
You're
it
like,
so much.
Especially the question we're always asking of the Khamzat, right, is who at middleweight could possibly stand up to this guy's pace and pressure? Who has the game plan to stop him? Doesn't seem like it's going to be Sean Strickland. I think he opened as like a 4-1 underdog in this fight, like most people would against Khamzat. But if we got in a situation where we're all asking ourselves, but has Khamzat ever faced an opponent who had a mysterious relationship with a possibly supernatural raven before? No, yeah. We don't know how his game would match up with that. It's a great unknown.
I am sold. Whoever asked that question just got the best part of it. They just got the best segment out of this. I had no idea about the raven, but dude, that is brilliant.
Short answer, yes, he would have a title shot if he had a raven.
Yeah.
Quite clear.
He would have already had a title shot. Yeah. A couple of them.
He'd be the champion.
Yeah.
I think I'll Happy St. Patrick's Day, Petey. Much love from Boston. Ah, Beantown. Oh, Boston. Tell you who knows a thing or two about Boston. Big time band folks.
Let me tell you
all
something.
All those Cool Ranch Doritos.
Yeah. I had a great time in Boston.
This guy.
It's harder than you think it is. I'm telling you. Try it. You try to point to that football helmet over your shoulder. See if you don't mix it up.
I don't even want to try.
One of the things that I really appreciate, I want to know, Chuck, you mentioned, I think maybe last week or the week before, what Francis Ngannou made per second to fight in the PFL.
Oh, yeah.
I want to know at this point in his career, how much is Alexander Ovechkin making per stride out on the ice?
Oh, my God.
Because he doesn't log a ton of ice time. He's mainly out there on the power play. He'll play the entire power play. He's out there every once in a while, but his shifts are not super long. And I've never seen somebody do it. You know, you've seen somebody do
an energy.
Like an unk walk, an unk run. He does an unk skate. And he's just completely not concerned. Yeah, he's really efficient with his energy out there. He's not skating up one single stride more than he has to. I would love to know what he's making and what it works out to. Every time he does this with his legs, I wonder how much he's getting paid.
How the hell did you get those seats, man? That's what I was wondering. Did you see his seats, Petey?
Yeah, ridiculous.
I tell you, the other best part about it was getting to see the Boston Bruins goalie, Jeremy Swayman, and his very intricate, very OCD routine. Every time there's a stoppage in play and he gets to come over to the bench, he has it. Like, we got to watch it enough times where you could be like, okay, now he's going to get a water bottle. He's going to do one squirt in his mouth and one squirt on the ice. He's going to scan the crowd. He's going to tighten his glove. He's going to switch water bottles. The best part is that at the very end of it, pulls his helmet back on, leans up, says something to the backup goaltender, who says something to him that makes him smile and laugh and relax a little bit as he skates back off. And I'm wondering, does the backup goaltender think this is a part of his job duties? This is what he does to help the club, is I got to have something funny to say to Swayman every time he comes over here.
Dude, goalies are cut different, man. Yes. Like, I've known some, and they all have their superstitions, and they all adhere to them completely. Like, it's a nutty lot over there, man.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think you understand how big of a compliment it is for Chuck Mendenhall to be complimenting your tickets. You ever see this fucking guy at games? I mean, for fuck's sake.
I mean, those were nice seats.
You got really nice seats. Yeah. That's right. I'm always in the nosebleeds, guys. If you just want
to,
you know.
And he wore like Washington gear. This is a guy who goes to rabble rouse. He's not there for pop.
I was in my Ovechkin shirt. A woman asked to take a picture of it. So I'm not afraid.
Fair play. I've been to the TD Garden. I saw the Celtics play the Chicago Bulls in 2015.
It's a good game.
Just saying.
Did you buy yourself a $14 beer or whatever they are? Because I tell you, what I dropped on just a few soda pops at this game.
I'm used to this, man. It's like it's everywhere now. Pizza, you didn't go to the TD Garden to see your boy McGregor fight?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was there. I was in way better seats. I was right there.
Weird. I would have thought they'd have something like that at Croke Park.
Yeah.
Ah, no.
That's as fictional as the Raven right about now.
Won't have any slant. Okay, Croke Park's a big deal. I'm going to bring Connor Burks there so he can say, yeah, I did see it. It's a real place.
Is Connor going over?
Yeah, he's going over in the first week of April. Hope he likes drinking. That's all I'm gonna say.
I don't know. I don't think so.
Love the show, gentlemen. I have a semi personal question. What non sports books? Sorry.
How did you fuck that up?
it's a book question, too, and you can't read it.
Let me go back. I'm sorry. I was like, what a time to pause. Love the show, gentlemen. I have a semi personal question. What non sports book have you most recommended to your friends? Ooh.
God.
You don't want to get me started.
I was going to say.
Because I won't stop. I'll say this, though. One of the books that I recommend to people a lot and have given as a gift to people a lot is The Sisters Brothers by Patrick DeWitt, really, like, very good, but also somehow very hilarious novels about a pair of brothers who are hired gunslingers in the Old West. And it is as fun as that sounds. So
that was a good one, man. That was a good one.
Yeah.
You know, another one?
Something exactly like
this has also been folks' favorite. And he recommended it to me. It's this one right here. Do you remember this
one? Oh, yeah. I love that book. Absolutely. Yeah. I don't know if that one is for everybody in the MMA-adjacent audience.
I just got a lot of books on my desk. And I was like, I know Ben mentioned this one before.
Department of Speculation by Jenny Offel. Jenny Offel is really great. It's one of those books, though, where you pick it up, and for the first 40 or so pages, you're going, what are we doing here?
I know. Yeah.
I don't know, but it is.
It's very unique. Very unique. It's good, though. I mean, it's too many. There's too many to name. I mean, most books I read are not sports books, so it just depends on the circumstance and what you're looking for, I guess.
Give us one, Chuck. He wants a recommendation. Give him
anything by Bernard Malamud. I think that he's like one of those writers. I feel like he has no duds. Like every book, The Natural. I mean, I guess that is sport. It's about a sports, but like The Magic Barrel is very good. Like any of his, they're all very good.
I would also say you kind of can't go wrong with Anthony Doerr, who wrote All the Light We Cannot See, the rare one where you go, I don't want to read another World War II novel, but this one is different than any World War II novel you read, and it's amazing.
That's a good one.
Even though he's one of those guys where he can write a 500-page book that doesn't feel like a 500-page book because each chapter is two or three pages, and his more recent one, Cloud Cuckoo Land, also really great.
Yeah.
I'd recommend anything by Irvine Welsh. He's my favorite writer, one of the best things I ever did was my friend Sans gave me a copy of Trainspotting when I was still in school, when I was 13 or so, And the way it's written, completely colloquial, spelled out in Scottish patter, unbelievable. And he releases books in that series to this day. I mean, he might take a few books off, but he comes back to it. I love all of his stuff. I've never loved an author like I do him. So anything by him would be my recommendation. I love Evan Welsh.
I love it. We need more of those questions. That's fun.
Love you guys. Thanks for the show every week. Thank you, Tom Tanaka, I believe your name was. Went too quickly. Thank you, Andy. Well, lads, another beautiful day spent in your company. Chuck off Gallivant next week. So, yep, Ben, yep, you can't let me down. Imagine just show, it's just me going with the list.
This is like, the White House card. Me not being there is like losing Taporia or something like that. It's not that big of a deal, but it hurts. You know what I mean?
Losing me is like losing Dawkins. You know what I mean? No,
he's kind of... Al Dawkins is on the card. What?
Yeah, what the fuck?
So I don't know if you guys have seen his response on social media. He's playing it right, though.
He is. He's nailing it. He's absolutely killing it.
He's funny, though.
Andy, thank you so much. Ben, thank you so much. Chuck, thank you so much. Oscar, thank you so much. Thank you, crackheads. Enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the fights. We'll be back next week. Not Chuck, but the rest of us will. We'll see you then. Love you. Mwah. Fucking kill that joke.